Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver, Brian Lynn, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, after 11 years, Tiger Woods finally did it again. On Sunday, the world-famous golfer won the 2019 Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, his first major victory since 2008. The win marks the fifth time Woods has won the Masters competition. The last time was in 2005. Sunday's victory was not entirely unexpected. Woods ended last year by winning the Tour Championship at East Lake Golf Club in Atlanta, Georgia. Woods told the Associated Press, "The win at East Lake was a big confidence booster for me because I had come close last year a couple times. Still have to get it across the finish line, and I didn't quite do it." Woods lost what many considered to be his perfect public image to a sex scandal in 2009. He also suffered back problems, which required 4 surgeries. He went 2 years without even playing a major tournament. Now, his comeback is complete. Woods is 3 wins short of the record of 18 major victories set by golfing great Jack Nicklaus. "A big well done from me to Tiger," Nicklaus wrote on Twitter. "I am so happy for him and for the game of golf." The next major golf tournament will be the PGA Championship from May 16th to 19th. A Reuters reporter asked Woods whether Nicklaus should be concerned about his record being broken. Woods said, "I don't know if he's worried or not. I'm just enjoying 15.
A major fire began to burn Monday at France's world-famous Notre-Dame de Paris Cathedral. Flames could be seen rising through the top of the monument. Its tall, narrow spire later collapsed. The cathedral dates back to the 12th century. French writer Victor Hugo used it as the setting of his famous story, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, first published in 1831. The cathedral is one of the world's most famous tourist sites. About 12 million people visit Notre Dame each year. It sits in the center of Paris, along the Seine River. The mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, wrote on Twitter Monday, "A terrible fire is underway at Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris." Hidalgo added that Paris firefighters were still trying to contain the fire. She urged people to stay away from the area. As the cathedral's roof continued to burn, a police officer near the scene told Reuters news agency, "Everything is collapsing." French President Emmanuel Macron delayed a planned scheduled speech to the nation because of the fire. The speech was to present his answers to the yellow vest crisis that has taken over the country since November. Macron arrived at the scene of the fire Monday night. The cause of the fire was not immediately known. France 2 television reported that police were treating it as accidental. Workers had been renovating parts of Notre Dame. Parts of the monument were surrounded by a metal and wood support structure. The cathedral's bronze statues had been removed last week for repairs. Notre Dame's first stone was laid in 1163 by Pope Alexander III. Its main spire was added during repairs in the 19th century. I'm Katie Weaver.
The operator of Japan's Fukushima nuclear center has begun removing fuel from a reactor that melted down in a 2011 accident. The Tokyo Electric Company, also known as TEPCO, said Monday it had successfully removed the first of more than 560 mostly used fuel units inside a pool in the reactor's Unit 3. The operation marked the first time TEPCO has removed fuel from the highly polluted building containing the Unit 3 reactor. Workers are controlling removal equipment from a room away from the building because of high levels of radiation. Unit 3 was one of three reactors at the Fukushima plant to suffer meltdowns after a 2011 earthquake and tsunami shut down the plant's cooling systems. It was the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl in 1986. The accident forced 160,000 people to flee poisoned areas near the plant, and many never returned. The fuel units were not broken in the accident, but the pools that hold them sit about 18 meters above ground and are not fully contained. The units are being moved to safer ground to avoid a possible new disaster in case another major earthquake hits. Fukushima's reactors 4 through 6 were not operating at the time, so they did not melt down. However, Unit 4 was damaged by an explosion in the days after the tsunami. TEPCO finished removing all the nuclear fuel kept inside Unit 4's storage pool in December 2014. Officials have said the current operations at Unit 3 are expected to be completed by March 2021. After that, TEPCO plans to continue with the removal of about 1,000 nuclear fuel units from the storage pools of reactors 1 and 2. After those removals are completed, TEPCO will begin a much bigger effort, clearing melted fuel from inside the reactors. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Sometimes, a little self-criticism is not a bad thing. We can all learn much from our mistakes. However, too much of it may affect your brain and your life. Negative self-talk. It is that little voice in your head that judges you. It says you are not good enough. It reminds you of all your faults and mistakes.
Negative self-talk actually determines the outcomes in our lives. The way we talk to ourselves about ourselves and the way we talk to other people about ourselves literally creates the outcomes in our lives.
That is Professor Paul Hughes. He is an educator and researcher on how the mind controls behavior. He says the way we talk to ourselves and about ourselves to other people can affect every part of our lives, from our career to our family life. Hughes saw this firsthand while teaching at a community college. He noticed that some students who studied hard and came to class every day still did poorly on exams. He wondered why.
What I discovered is that there are some students who are doing all the right things. They are good students. They show up for class. They do their homework. They study hard. But when it comes to exam time, they fold under the pressure.
Students may do everything right, but when it comes time to take a test, they do not do well. They may suffer from something commonly called test anxiety. So why do good students sometimes do poorly on tests? Hughes uses a common expression to explain. If there is a lot on the line, there is a lot a student can lose. The result, they get nervous and test poorly.
It is test anxiety because students have their futures on the line. They understand that if they get good grades in exams, they're going to have more choices of colleges that they can attend, and in some cases, even careers they can pursue. And it puts a lot of pressure on them.
Hughes explains that failing several tests can affect a student's confidence and future test performances. This, he says, can become a pattern.
Once that happens, that triggers a pattern. When you continually fail at something, and I know this from my study of psychology, we all engage, whether it's exams or anything else, we all wind up talking to ourselves, negative self-talk, without even realizing we're doing it, saying, like, why can't I remember what I studied? Why do I get so tense? Those statements actually reprogram the same negative outcome over and over and over.
Hughes used one of his students at a community college as an example. Lindsay was a good student. She came to class early, took part in discussions, and did all of her homework. However, she did poorly on exams. When Hughes asked her how she felt before a test, she told him she was very tense. She wondered why she had trouble remembering what she had studied. She said she did not trust that she knew the right answers. Hughes took Lindsay's negative statements and turned them into positive questions. Before a test, he told Lindsay to say to herself, "Why am I so relaxed when I take an exam? Why am I so focused during my exam? Why do I remember everything I study for an exam? Why do I trust my answers?" Lindsay took his advice. 2 weeks later, she took an exam in another class and scored 15 points higher than she had on an earlier exam. 4 weeks later, she earned a B on the final exam in Professor Hughes's class. Lindsay left community college and went to a 4-year university. She continued to use the method of positive self-talk. When Professor Hughes checked up on her a year later, she had good news to share. She had gotten straight A's on all of her exams. Hughes saw student after student succeed with his method, so he decided to write a book about the subject. His book is called Change Your Grades, Change Your Life. He claims that his method of positive self-talk works with all the students who have tried it. He adds that they got more than just good test scores. They got their self-confidence back. Again, here is Hughes.
The biggest outcome, by the way, of every single student who succeeds with this is that they get their self-confidence back. You start failing exams and you've got teachers judging you, you've got parents judging you, and they're judging you not even realizing that you're having this problem. The more students that I can get to restore their self-esteem and send them further on into life and into adulthood with good self-confidence is a huge win-win.
Hughes does not just help his students. He also uses his positive self-talk to help friends and neighbors. In a television interview, he summed it up this way. We can program ourselves for success in class or in life, or we can program ourselves for failure. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Woodrow Wilson's first year as president showed the American people that they had elected a strong and effective leader. Wilson took office in 1913. He moved quickly to fulfill his campaign promises. He won congressional approval for lower import taxes, a new tax on earnings, and restrictions on the power of big companies. These were some of the most important economic reforms the nation had seen in many years. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue the story of Wilson's administration.
Most of Woodrow Wilson's political victories were on national issues. He had little experience with international issues. But foreign events soon began to demand more and more of his time. With all of his successes at home, it is a surprising fact of history that his presidency is remembered best for its foreign policy. The story of Woodrow Wilson's foreign policy is full of high ideas and political bravery, but it also is a story of fierce struggle and lost hopes. It is a story that begins across America's southern border in Mexico.
At that time, Mexico had been ruled for many years by Porfirio Diaz. As Diaz grew older, his power began to weaken. In 1911, a revolt broke out. It was led by Francisco Madero, the leader of a land reform movement. Diaz understood he could not win. He resigned and fled the country. Madero declared himself president. However, powerful groups in Mexico opposed him. In a short time, one of his own generals, Victoriano Huerta, arrested him. Madero was murdered soon after Huerta seized power. President Wilson refused to recognize Huerta's government. He believed other forces would rise up against him. Wilson was right. Another revolt began, led by General Venustiano Carranza.
Wilson offered aid to Carranza. Carranza rejected the offer. He was afraid of American interference in Mexico. He told Wilson that Mexican troops would do all the fighting. He only wanted guns and ammunition. American forces did, however, get involved in the conflict. President Wilson learned that a ship from Germany was bringing supplies to the Huerta government. The ship would land at the Mexican port of Veracruz. Wilson ordered the United States Navy to seize and occupy the port. The move started a storm of criticism in the United States and throughout Latin America.
Many people denounced President Wilson. They called him an imperialist and a fool. They asked, what right did the United States have to interfere in Mexico? Wilson finally stopped American military action in Mexico. He tried to settle the dispute at an international conference at Niagara Falls, Canada. The effort failed. The conference did not produce a settlement. While the diplomats were talking, Carranza's revolutionary forces were fighting. They moved on Mexico City, the capital. President Huerta fled. Carranza formed a new government.
The new government began to split apart almost immediately. Another general, Francisco Pancho Villa, tried to seize power. He forced Carranza out of Mexico City. Then he formed his own government. President Wilson recognized Villa and his government. Carranza, however, refused to give up. Day by day, his army grew stronger. He forced Villa to retreat. Then President Wilson recognized Carranza's government. Like Carranza, Villa refused to give up. He decided to try to start a war between Mexico and the United States. Pancho Villa wanted the United States to attack Carranza. Then he would step in to lead Mexican forces in battle. That would make him a hero. With this plan in mind, Pancho Villa attacked an American town across the border in Texas. He killed 19 persons.
President Wilson immediately ordered a large American force to find and punish Villa. At first, Carranza welcomed the move. Villa was his enemy. He wanted him captured. Then, Carranza began to fear that the American troops might threaten his government. He demanded the withdrawal of all American soldiers from Mexico. Tensions increased between the two countries. Villa's forces attacked another town in Texas. President Wilson considered asking Congress to declare war, but the crisis cooled down before then. American forces were withdrawn, and the people of Mexico elected a new government. They chose Carranza as president.
Thank you.
As President Wilson dealt with the situation in Mexico, trouble began to surface in another part of the world. The crisis was in Europe. Tensions were growing between several groups of nations. They were on the edge of what would become World War I. The major powers in Europe had been threatening each other for years, but they had not fought for more than 40 years. Most Americans believed there would never be another European war. Such a war would be unbelievably destructive. Millions would die. No nation would win.
Europe depended on a balance of power to keep the peace. On one side were the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. On the other side were the members of the Triple Entente, Britain, France, and Russia. Each side made every effort to win the support of Europe's smaller nations. A number of nations refused to join either side. The neutrals included Switzerland, Belgium, the Netherlands, and the Scandinavian countries.
This political balance did not prevent the major nations from competing with each other for colonies and economic power. They competed all over the world, in China, in the Middle East, in Africa, everywhere money could be invested. Competition was especially sharp in the Balkans. This was the area of Europe between the Adriatic and Black Seas. Many nations claimed special interests in the Balkans, and several Balkan countries were fighting each other. The whole continent seemed ready to explode.
The spark that set off the explosion came in the city of Sarajevo. The date was June 28, 1914. Sarajevo had been taken over by Austria, and the Archduke of Austria, Ferdinand, had come for a visit. Ferdinand was expected to become the next emperor of Austria. Seven young extremists from the area decided to assassinate the Archduke to protest Austrian control. One of the extremists threw a bomb at the royal family. The bomb missed its target, but another extremist shot at the group. He killed both the Archduke and the Archduke's wife.
The assassinations in Sarajevo started a series of events that quickly brought war to all of Europe. Soon the continent was covered with armies, battles, and death.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.